The weather and climate often cause concern and curiosity. But understanding the facts behind the phenomena can be a challenge. We're here to help. From the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Illinois Public Media, welcome to Weather Realness, a weekly podcast about the skies above Illinois and the world.
I'm your host, Deanna Hintz, Associate Professor in the Department of Climate, Meteorology, and Atmospheric Sciences at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. Illinois has experienced severe storms, heat waves, and changing weather this year. But climatologists are looking into a climate phenomenon that, although happening thousands of miles away, could shape our weather in the coming months, El Niño. Scientists are predicting this year's El Niño could be a strong one, but what does that warming Pacific Ocean mean for Illinois? Joining us to talk about how El Niño will impact Illinois is Trent Ford, Illinois State Climatologist with the Prairie Research Institute. Trent, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks, Deanna.
So Trent, how does El Niño affect the weather in Illinois? What do we usually experience with those impacts?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting to think about something that's going on in the Pacific affecting us here in the Midwest, but it definitely does. And El Niño actually, and the reason that it gets so much attention is that it really has an impact in most climates in the world. Here in the Midwest, and I say the Midwest instead of Illinois because it tends to have a more regional effect. So it's very much similar in Illinois as it is in Indiana and Iowa and Wisconsin. We tend to see the biggest impact in climatological winter, which is December, January, and February. A little bit less of an impact in fall, so September, October, November. A little bit less of an impact in March, and almost no impact in the summer normally. So we'll start with winter because that's the most relevant. The biggest, I'd say like by far the most dominant signal during El Niño winters is a milder overall winter, meaning a higher average temperature during the wintertime, December, January, February. That is a very strong signal pretty much throughout most of Central North America, all the way from Northern Canada down to, kind of Southern Missouri, Southern Illinois. When we look at past El Niños, even over just the last 30 to 40 years, something like 8 out of 10 of them have had a higher than normal average temperature for Illinois, which, you know, as you know, Deanna, anything that you get 8 out of 10 times in weather and climate is a very strong signal, right?
Exactly.
Very often. So that's the biggest signal. We also do tend to see a little bit of a drier signal in winter, especially along the Ohio Valley. So thinking about kind of Southern Illinois up to Western Pennsylvania, but that's a little bit of a weaker thing. So we definitely see the biggest impact on temperatures. When we go outside of winter, we see a little bit of a drier fall during El Niños. Again, a signal where more drier falls than wetter falls. And then for spring, we tend to see a little bit of a warmer spring. But again, those two patterns are much weaker. Those two signals are much weaker in the Midwest in the fall and the spring relative to winter. So the big thing is milder winter, maybe a little bit drier as well.
Sometimes we hear about how El Niño really impacts places like the West Coast or other parts of the country. Why do they seem to be stronger in some of those other parts of the country than here in the Midwest?
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing is that over the course of the last several months, as we've seen forecasts of this El Niño event, and then it's come to fruition, and we see it. I mean, the forecasts and the outlooks in February were on it. It's amazing how well these models do, saying back in February, hey, this could be not only an El Niño, but an extremely strong El Niño, and it looks like it's heading that way. And the dominant narrative around that nationally and internationally is this is a bad thing. And I don't want to diminish the problematic impacts that El Niño has in many places of the world: wildfire, drought, in some cases, food insecurity issues that are exacerbated by El Niño, including some parts of sub-Saharan Africa and the Indian subcontinent. Those monsoons could be affected. But here in the Midwest, we tend to see the impact as, again, that milder winter, which is I don't know. It's sort of I don't know if a double-edged sword or not is the best way to put it, but in some ways it's beneficial. We think about energy use. We tend to use less energy during our milder winters, which is kind of nice from an economic standpoint as well as a climate standpoint. We also tend to see fewer cold-related, or I guess just say less cold-related mortality and morbidity, especially in our urban areas in our milder winters. I mean, cold is still, extreme cold temperatures is still a severe weather hazard, and we definitely see less of that in our milder winters. We see other things. I mean, obviously, a milder winter exacerbates already warming trends in the Midwest in wintertime, which can make for things like invasive or non-native species. And we've heard a lot about ticks this year. You know, the expansion of species like the Gulf Coast tick is at least partly linked with warming winters. So you have that trend, and then El Nino added to that can be problematic. But yeah, I mean, I think the reason we don't hear El Nino's impact as much in the Midwest kind of nationally is because it doesn't tend to be as impactful for the Midwest as it does for the Western U.S. and the Southeast U.S. and then places like Australia and Peru and India. But also is because the milder winter that is such a strong signal of the El Nino impacts the Midwest is not maybe as interesting as some of the other impacts that it can bring.
I think one thing that I think people do really think about when we think about a warmer winter is, well, we still could also have really sharp cold snaps and snowstorms. So why is that? Why is it that, we can have these both things happening?
Yeah, that's a really important point. So when I've talked to folks in the last few months about El Nino, it means a milder winter in general, or it can bring a milder winter, at least it tends to. The next question is, well, okay, that means less snow, right? And I was like, yes and no, right? It's always yes and no. In general, our warmer winters historically have meant less snow, and perhaps that can mean fewer winter storm events, but not always. And the reason being is that winter is this season that is more than any other, where we experience winter very different than as humans than winter is often characterized climatologically. So we think about winter, and I'm telling you all about this with El Nino, that it makes for milder winters. So here's what we're going to do. On March 1st, we're going to go back the previous 3 months, December, January, and February, and we're going to say, what was the average temperature for the whole state of Illinois? We're going to say it's whatever it is, it's X. Is that above the 30-year normal or below the 30-year normal? Okay, it's 0.1 degrees Fahrenheit warmer than the 30-year normal. Therefore, our prognostication was correct. We were, El Nino will create a milder winter. When in reality, we don't experience a winter that's 0.1 degrees Fahrenheit above average. We experienced the winter where it was mild, 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 and then my house got hit by a major storm and it dropped 10 inches of snow or maybe half an inch of ice, and we were out of power for 3 days. And then it was mild after that. And so how we experience winter is often in the storms and the extremes, the extreme cold, but also those winter storms that come by. And those winter storms are, and the extreme cold, for example, are more weather phenomenon. So yes, El Nino is sort of playing the weather patterns up to make for these more frequent periods of milder weather. However, it can also be those periods of milder weather can be interspersed with really significant storms. And this part of the state here in central Illinois and in northern Illinois, if we have that milder winter, what that means in late January and February is it's more likely that our temperatures are staying in that range that makes for really, really efficient snowmaking. So there's an old adage or whatever you want to call it that my family would say all the time and say, oh, it's too cold to snow. It's never too cold to snow, but it's true that the combining the temperature which we can make snow and the water holding capacity of the air, that we get most efficient snow from our storms in winter between about 25 and 35 degrees Fahrenheit. And so In the wintertime, in January and February especially, in northern Illinois especially, we tend to see the average temperature start to dip below that. Well, if our warmer winter or milder winter pushes us more of those days in that efficient snowmaking, we can actually get more snow paradoxically in those milder winters.
If you're just joining us, this is Weather Realness, the podcast about weather and climate from Illinois Public Media and the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. I'm Deanna Hintz, Associate Professor in the Department of Climate, Meteorology, and Atmospheric Sciences at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. We're talking with Trent Ford, Illinois State Climatologist with the Prairie Research Institute. Can you explain to us a bit about how climate change does or does not, or how much it interacts with El Nino?
Climate change does have an impact on El Nino and the entire El Nino Southern Oscillation. It is extremely complex, and I feel like that's just the answer to everything, of course. But because El Nino is, and again, La Nina in that phase between them is it's driven by these really complex ocean atmosphere interactions. We, even though we've seen a fairly consistent response of our climates to global warming, right? We've seen that global average temperature increase. And as much as the atmosphere's temperature has increased over the last 150 years, the ocean's temperature has increased more. So you would expect to say, hey, higher ocean temperatures should mean more El Nino conditions. And in fact, when we look at our models going back in time, the last 20 years, a lot of those global climate models have projected more frequent or a tendency for more El Nino patterns relative to La Nina patterns into the future. And that makes sense. What's interesting is over the last 20 years, we haven't seen that. In fact, we've seen far more La Nina patterns than El Nino patterns. Part of that is contributing to this mega drought that we've seen over the Southwest United States. So there's a lot still unknown about how exactly El Nino and La Nina respond to a warmer overall world, a warmer global climate. Certainly, one thing that we do see is, and I kind of allude to this a little bit with the discussion of winter, El Nino can add to the effects of climate change. I use the Midwest as the example. Our winters are getting warmer. That makes it easier for certain types of non-native invasive species of plants and animals to overwinter farther north and therefore cause problems then in the coming growing season. Well, you know, that happens in El Nino and La Nina years because we see that increasing trend in winter temperatures. However, when we get an El Nino year, that makes it for an even warmer winter than would normally be experienced. It exacerbates that effect. Now, ticks are bad, right? In general, but wildfires are also bad. So we see that example of that amplifying effect in places like northern Australia, where El Nino patterns typically mean drier, hotter summers, and therefore a higher wildfire risk. That is also combining with an overall climate change trend in northern Australia for hotter and drier summers that make for an even larger wildfire risk. So in some ways, we know that climate change and El Nino are interacting, or climate change is changing El Nino and La Nina in some very complicated ways that still require a lot of research to better understand.
So the last thing I wanted to talk to you about, Trent, is one of the things that we're most famous for here in the state of Illinois. Of course, we don't like to brag too much, but Illinois is one of the country's strongest agricultural states. And one of the big ways that our field of the atmospheric sciences contributes to our agricultural economy is through seasonal predictions. So one thing I wanted to ask you is, you know, how confident are climatologists when making seasonal outlooks? And how does El Nino help or hurt making those predictions more accurate?
So it is really challenging. You know, if you look at your weather forecast for tomorrow, whenever tomorrow may be, it's going to be fairly accurate, especially with temperature. It'll be pretty precise, too. So it's not only going to give you what the forecasters think will happen with the high temperature, it's going to give you an idea of when that high temperature is going to occur. And if it's going to, if it, there's a chance of rain, it's going to be able to, you're going to be able to tell from the forecast when forecasters believe it's going to start raining, perhaps in the afternoon or the morning, whatever that may be. That's both accuracy, because those forecasts are quite accurate, despite what a lot of people think. And it's also precise. For seasonal climate prediction, we can maintain some of that accuracy, but we lose the precision. So with seasonal climate prediction, what we see is still the forecast, the prediction of what the next season is going to bring, the next month's weather of season, maybe even the next year's weather is going to bring. But the precision is much less precise. So when we look at the Climate Prediction Center, which is NOAA's branch of climate prediction, what we see is the monthly outlook or the three-month seasonal outlook is showing sort of a tercile. So the chances of above average temperature or precipitation or below average temperature or precipitation. And that's what we can do because we can't say what the temperature is going to be like a month from now or how much rain we're going to get in 2 months with that level of precision. So when we think about the skill, the accuracy of seasonal climate prediction, it's there. We have good skill. I think the real issue with seasonal climate prediction is that the lack of precision limits the usability for a lot of applications. So you mentioned farmers as a stakeholder group. You know, farmers don't work off of averages so much, at least for weather, right? And so we think, say, well, we have a best chance of being above average temperatures. That's great. And let's say that's the case for April, just showing a hypothetical example. And you say April is going to be warmer than average. Fantastic. I'm going to get my bean crop in early because it's warm. And it is. April's warm throughout. And then on April 30th, you get a big cold outbreak, which happens in April in Illinois. And the beans that have now germinated and emerged are now frostbitten, and you have problems, right? Well, guess what? In that situation, our seasonal climate forecast, it verified. We high five each other. Not really. I'm being hyperbolic. But, you know, it's basically like, hey, it verified. We did a good job because we forecasted that it was going to be warmer than average in April, which is, by the way, is a warmer than average. It's a monthly average temperature. But what you really care about, which is the soybeans, is a problematic because we can't predict when a extreme, like a late spring freeze, is going to occur a month ahead of time. So, I think that the next frontier in seasonal climate prediction is, there's lots of frontiers in seasonal climate prediction. One is trying to use AI to maybe become a little bit more precise, but that usability is really key, and trying to predict not just what we think we can be accurate with as far as the climate, but what we think is actually useful for the people we're trying to communicate with, which is still a major gap. And a lot of people are working on the problem. So to answer your question about El Nino, though, El Nino is actually a boon for seasonal climate prediction because there are so few patterns in our climate world that are reliably predictable at any more than 2 to 3 weeks out, that, you know, climate forecasters just will grab whatever they can to try to get some of that skill, some of that predictability, and El Nino provides that predictability. So I mentioned, you know, the biggest impact in the Midwest is warmer, milder temperatures in the wintertime. When we look at likely, we're recording this in late July here, and when we look at the outlooks that are going to come out from the Climate Prediction Center over the next few months that get us closer to winter, I will bet a lot of money that there are going to be warmer signals in the Midwest because they're grabbing onto that El Nino. They're saying there's not a whole lot of signal from anything else, but we know that El Nino generally means warmer temperatures here. And oh, by the way, climate change is making our winters warmer too, so we can hang our hat on that a little bit higher predictability. So El Nino does help with the accuracy. It still doesn't get us past that precision problem with seasonal prediction, but certainly with the accuracy of seasonal climate prediction, El Nino can definitely be beneficial.
If you're just joining us, this is Weather Realness, the podcast about weather and climate from Illinois Public Media and the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. I'm Deanna Hintz, Associate Professor in the Department of Climate, Meteorology, and Atmospheric Sciences at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. We're talking with Trent Ford, Illinois State Climatologist with the Prairie Research Institute. Well, it's interesting you say that about the reservoirs, because some things that we're definitely finding is that when those rainfall events come too fast and too large, it can have different impacts in terms of damaging those reservoirs. But that's another discussion, perhaps for another day. But, you know, bringing it back to those winter and maybe springtime impacts, because, of course, where those seasonal predictions really can have a big impact is around that. What is the precipitation in the wintertime and the springtime, and what kind of impacts they could have on planting decisions for the next year? So how can these changes in winter and springtime precipitation impact the soil for farmers in Illinois?
Yeah, you know, what we receive in the wintertime as far as precipitation, and especially in the spring, definitely goes to the reserve we have for the summertime here in Illinois for crops. Both perennial and annual cropping systems definitely respond to the higher frequency weather variability. So day-to-day weather variability, week-to-week weather variability sort of is different than what El Nino really influences. That being said, we do see an effect on perennial cropping systems. And so perennial cropping systems, thinking about orchards, vineyards, you know, a lot of the basically cropping systems that aren't just an annual crop of putting it in the ground and taking it out in the same season. So when you think about apple trees, or apples, peaches, cherries, blueberries, grapes, these are trees, bushes, vines that are going to respond to the winter climate and winter weather as much as they are to the summer weather. So something that we have seen in recent years, not so much an El Nino signal, but more of a climate change signal, is warmer winters changing the phenology timing of those systems, so that we can break dormancy and sort of unpredictable ways, in some cases too early, that can make those systems, those trees, those bushes more susceptible to freeze events that just naturally happen in the springtime. So this has happened. I mean, some of our strongest, mildest winters, think 2007, 2012 here in Illinois, also came along with really significant crop, especially fruit crop damage, because those trees broke dormancy so early, it just put them at a higher vulnerability to the spring freeze. So that's going to be a signal that I'm watching throughout this winter, to see how quickly those trees are progressing through their dormancy period and how quickly they may be showing signs of breaking dormancy. And, you know, if we do get that milder winter that is so consistent with El Nino, that may be something we're going to be communicating about and watching with growers come spring.
That makes a lot of sense. And that makes me curious, then, what would you tell farmers who are worried about how this super El Nino will impact their crop production in the coming year?
There are both chemical and physical mechanisms that farmers can use to slow that phenology shift in those trees. Also understanding how what stage of phenology those trees are at, combined with the weather forecast. There are lots of different ways that those orchards and vineyards can help their trees or help their plants be resilient to that extreme cold. But the biggest thing is just making sure that folks, that producers, are aware of, hey, we've accumulated a lot of what we call chilling, basically chilling hours or chilling days, and that your trees are likely going to be well advanced of phenology if that does happen. Therefore, you should be scouting more frequently and considering these approaches to slowing down that phenology if we do indeed see those signs. At the same time, this goes both for perennial cropping systems and annual cropping systems. What we can see in some of these warmer winters is a change in the timing of both disease and insect pressure on those crops. Perhaps insects can go through life stages a bit quicker or get a bigger jump on their life stages. Diseases may be able to overwinter a little bit easier and kind of ride those southerly winds in early spring more effectively. And so a lot of times farmers will have sort of a pattern of when we begin to scout for this pest, this disease, and then to understand whether we need to treat for them or not. In some cases of milder winters, those scouting timelines need to be moved up earlier in the season in order to manage those kinds of pests. And so again, it's a situation that is still the farmers making decisions about what they're doing, what they're seeing. But we can use those seasonal forecasts and the observations of what the winter is doing to help inform, let's say, hey, this is something you should be watching out for.
Well, Trent, you've given us so much to think about. Thank you for helping break this out down for us today.
Yeah. Thanks a bunch, Deanna.
We've been talking with Trent Ford, Illinois State Climatologist with the Prairie Research Institute. And I'm Deanna Hentz, Associate Professor in the Department of Climate, Meteorology, and Atmospheric Sciences at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. Thank you for joining us on Weather Realness. Do you have a weather or climate question you want us to answer? Leave us a voicemail at 217-333-2141 or email weatherrealness@illinois.edu.
Weather Realness is produced by Trent Ford, Jeff Frame, Deanna Hentz, Stephen Nesbitt, Stephanie Orellana, Eddie Wolf, and me, Joseph Trujillo Falcon. Production is partially funded by the Backlund Charitable Trust. This podcast is a partnership between the Department of Climate, Meteorology, and Atmospheric Sciences and Illinois Public Media, a service of the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. Thank you for listening.